Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, secularization, the rise of Islam, and the search for Christian unity on the agenda at a meeting in preparation for the Third Ecumenical Assembly of European Churches. The Holy See leading efforts to ban the use of deadly cluster bombs, which continue to kill after conflicts have ended. And inspirational women from the New Testament. That was the focus of Pope Benedict's reflections at his general audience this Wednesday. Welcome to the programme. Christians from across West and Eastern Europe are meeting this week in the German town of Wittenberg, home to the church where Martin Luther is said to have nailed his 95 theses to the door, sparking the Reformation movement. Participants there are preparing for the Third European Ecumenical Assembly, to be held in September in Sibiu, Romania, the first time such a major ecumenical meeting will take place in a majority Orthodox nation. The preparatory session starting this Thursday focuses on secularization as a challenge for all the churches, the place of Catholic and Protestant theology in the ecumenical movement, and reconciliation as a key to Christian unity.
The whole reality of reconciliation and healing, which is deeply rooted in the way Christians understand their faith generally, is also a great challenge between Christians to recognize, and very much part of the reflection of these next few days here in this third stage and into Sibiu, to be recognizing what it means to be forgiving towards the other.
Among the delegates is Monsignor Andrew Fahey, Assistant General Secretary to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, with responsibility for ecumenism and interfaith relations.
This particular gathering, it's very much focusing again on the place of the church in Europe, the church's vision for Europe today, and considering through shared reflection and particularly prayer, the overall theme of the assembly in Sibiu, the light of Christ shines upon all. So it's very much within that context that people are gathering here in Wittenberg to celebrate a shared faith, a shared response to what the challenge of modern Europe offers to Christians today.
As you say, the meeting in September will be held in Sibiu, which is for the first time, if you like, a meeting being held, meeting like this being held in the heart of the Orthodox world. That's going to have a huge impact, isn't it, on the proceedings, on the work that's going on?
Yes, I think it will. We're certainly hoping that it will, so that we're able to celebrate together with those deeply Christian and a very, very rich history within those Christian communities in Sibiu and Romania generally, to share with them what they bring to a strengthening and a challenging of the Christian vision for Europe in the broadest sense. And it'll be a marvelous opportunity for us to celebrate together through the range of Christian traditions within Europe, but particularly being hosted by the Orthodox and other Christian traditions within Romania itself.
Some would say, though, that the incredibly diverse situations to be found, for example, in a country like Romania compared to a country like your own Great Britain, or indeed a country like this, Italy, the situation of the churches are so different that it must be hard to draw much in the way of common denominators that can really help to forge a way forward, if that's indeed what you're looking for.
Well, I think that's true on the one hand, but on the other, what the assembly and the whole process of reflection, which includes these next few days here in Wittenberg, implies and means is also respecting and celebrating the common source of all Christian tradition, to be the Lord Jesus himself, the gospel, the church's tradition. And although it's true to say, inevitably, that history has imposed on the Christian tradition a wide and, if some, in some senses, a widening variety of traditions and commitments and understandings, it's still hugely important for us to recognize the common source for all Christian tradition, and in that way to be not just consolidating, but celebrating through prayer and reflection especially on what it means to be a Christian and a responsible Christian within the increasingly diverse reality of modern Europe.
To some extent, this is a debate really about whether the church has a public role to play in modern society or whether it really is a private affair for individuals who choose to believe, isn't it?
Well, yes, but again, I think the challenge for any Christian in any context, in any part of the world, and especially, therefore, for us in Europe, is to appreciate the Christian's responsibility and place within the world, particularly as reflected on so inspiringly by through Pope John, the late Pope John Paul II, and also taken up, I think, very, very clearly by Pope Benedict, currently for the Catholic tradition, that it's our responsibility, not just to keep the faith, but to proclaim it, and to be proclaiming it in a way that makes a challenge, that offers a challenge and makes a difference to the way society thinks of itself, that Christianity has never been a private religion. Christianity has never been bound by land or territory, but is very much about the transforming of the lives of individuals through example, through prayer, through commitment to the gospel and to the Lord himself.
You're talking about the changing religious makeup of our European countries, particularly with the arrival of large Islamic communities. How much is interfaith dialogue also going to be a focus of your discussions there?
Yes, the interreligious dialogue and relationships are very much part of the reflections leading towards Sibiu. They're one of the main themes through the process of discussion. So what we continue to do is to reflect on the relationship between Christian tradition and the other faith traditions in a way that takes seriously the principles of interreligious dialogue. But we are not in any way trying to blur the boundaries or the edges between one faith tradition and the other any more than that we would be doing that within the ecumenical context between Christians.
Every change in the debate offers difficulties and opportunities. I very much hope that the European churches have the capacity to seize the opportunities rather than, as it were, sink under the complexity of the debate.
Another participant at the Wittenberg meeting is Dr. Grace Davey, an Anglican professor of sociology from Exeter University and a specialist on issues of religion in contemporary Europe.
Clearly, the historic churches are still there, but they have lost the capacity, their capacity to discipline the beliefs and behaviour of most European people. I don't think anybody disputes that, and that I would call a process of secularisation. That is counteracted, a very different factor, is growing religious diversity in Europe, the arrival of significant numbers of Muslims in Europe, and the reopening of debates about religion in the public sphere, which many Europeans had thought were closed, definitively closed. That's a difficult situation, but it cannot be put under the rubric of secularisation. In some ways, it's the reverse.
As you say, it's almost an ambiguous attitude that many people have nowadays towards the churches. You're saying they want the churches to be there, but somehow not to interfere in the public sphere.
I would go a little bit further than that. They certainly want the churches to be there. I think very few people would prefer Europe without the churches, if they think it through at all. They certainly want them there for pastoral care at liminal moments, particularly at the time of a death. They're much less relaxed, if you like, about the presence of religion in the public sphere, though that's more difficult in some societies than others. But they most definitely don't want the churches, as it were, dictating anything in terms of private life, private morality, the decisions about families, that kind of thing, which they find intrusive.
In your opinion, how well are our European church leaders dealing with the implications of this huge change in mentality of believers, if you like, today?
I mean, I think some are finding it more difficult than others. And I think here you find the very powerful influence, which is sometimes a very positive thing, of the legacy of the state church, that it gives many advantages in terms of presence, in terms of influence, historic influence in the public sphere, which has not entirely gone in many places. I mean, England is a very good example. The Archbishop is highly influential, even if he has almost no power in the English case. But a state church, a territorially embedded church, a parish church, is also a very immobile church. And I think the European churches tend to be a little bit static. They find it difficult to react quickly to new situations. I think a great deal of work needs to be done on what I would call the advantages of a weak state church, instead of always majoring on the disadvantages of a strong state church. A strong state church is excluding and exclusive. That was so historically all over Europe, and still is in some parts of Europe. I mean, you notice it more in the Orthodox countries than you do elsewhere, but it can still be the case elsewhere. If you go with a much more positive reading, you could say that a much weaker state church keeps the advantages of the state church but uses it much more creatively, like making places in society for the seriously religious of whatever, or holding spaces in society for the seriously religious of whatever faith.
So are you saying that a weakening, if you like, of the traditionally dominant role of the churches should make the ecumenical and indeed the interfaith dialogue much easier in a way?
If it's used creatively, most certainly yes. But if used creatively is the key bit of that sentence, because it gives all sorts of opportunities, all sorts of, sufficient influence, clout in a local community to gather a meeting, to hold a meeting, to host a meeting, but not, as it were, the historic power that meant it was necessarily dominant. So I think, what I think is, as it were, the key is recognizing your legacy, not pretending it was different, because you can't do that. But, as it were, maximizing its advantages in the current really very complex situation.
The other point that you're underlining as one of the most significant influential factors on the future of the Christian churches is the arrival of large communities of other faith traditions,
yes,
Notably the Muslim populations in so many European countries. Is it fair to say, is it possible to say that this is perhaps the most significant factor that will shape the churches in Europe in the future?
It's one of, I don't know if it's the most significant. Don't forget in your analysis the arrival of very significant numbers of Christians from the global south, which is also changing the nature of the Christian churches. I mean, a very small example that I picked up the other day was it's Europe into Europe, which I think is an aspect of the debate we shouldn't forget. Enormous numbers of Polish people in England now, which is, in some parishes, totally transforming the Catholic Church. I mean, the one or two nice accounts over Christmas of churches in London that were absolutely packed to the doors, and it was primarily the Polish community. But Islam, I think, is particularly significant because the traditional mode, if you like, or one of the ways that Europe has dealt with religion in post-Enlightenment Europe is call it a private matter, and provided you keep out of public life, you can do more or less what you like. You know, you have freedom of belief and assembly, that kind of thing. But it's very difficult to privatize Islam. Privatized Islam is almost an oxymoron. And so many of the big clashes, if you think of the Rushdie controversy and you think of the Affaire du Foulard, if you think of the Danish cartoons, if you think of what happened in the Netherlands with Theo van Gogh, they were all public incidents, they're not private incidents. And it's this reassertion of religious issues in public debate, which I think is a consequence, or one of the consequences, of the renewed presence or growing presence of Islam in Europe. And that, I think, is a catalyst. It's altered the whole nature of the debate and required Europeans to rethink issues that they had thought had been resolved in terms of European history. And hence the debate about the European Constitution, the very difficult set of issues surrounding Turkish accession to the European Union, anxieties about the presence of Islam, which of course cannot be dissociated from debates in the wider world.
My thanks there to Dr. Grace Davey, a specialist on religion in contemporary Europe, and to Monsignor Andrew Fayley of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Now, can the international community agree on a new treaty to ban the use of deadly cluster bombs? Well, that's the hope of some 40 governments and civil society organisations who will be meeting in Oslo this month to launch an international process to ban cluster munitions. Last year's war in Lebanon and other conflicts, including those in Iraq, Afghanistan and the Balkans, shone the spotlight on the devastating effects that cluster bombs can have on the civilian population. Experts say a significant percentage of these munitions fail to explode on impact and as a result continue to maim and kill innocent people long after the conflicts have ended. The Holy See has proposed a moratorium on the use of cluster bombs as a first step in a process towards an international ban on their use. The proposal was made by the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi. He talked to my colleague Susie Hodges about the concerns surrounding these cluster munitions.
The problem that is emerging is the fact that these bombs are not really very effective. And second, that about 5 to 50% of them do not necessarily explode when they are thrown through a mortar or from the air. So there is a change of perception at this point in time, not only because the defense climate has changed, but also because there is a greater sensibility in public opinion that the non-reliability of these weapons need to be stopped and to be looked at in a serious way. About a dozen countries are advocating a moratorium on the use either of only some of these bombs or a total ban on the use of cluster bombs. The awareness that this weapon is no good for the civilian population in particular came about after the recent wars, the last 50 years, like Vietnam, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Lebanon, the Balkans, Ethiopia, where many cluster bombs, in fact by the millions, have been used. And there is like a double problem. One problem is in the utilization of these bombs, because there is an impossibility to distinguish between military and civilian population when they are used, because the fact that they explode in the air and they spread over an area that can go from 1 to 5 square kilometers, it affects innocent people, people who are not combatants. And another aspect is that in the utilization of these bombs, the sense of proportionality is not respected. You know, they are thrown in areas or in specific points with the aim of hitting military targets, but in fact, the spreading of these bombs affects other areas that are not at all military objectives. So in the use of these bombs, there is a problem, and there is a problem after the use of the bomb, after the conflict.
What does the Holy See? Does the Holy See support a moratorium, or is it moving towards the idea of an outright ban?
So many bombs remain unexploded, and they block, prevent the development of areas where they are disseminated, and because there are many victims, both in the peacekeeping troops in some areas and especially among the civilians, that the humanitarian aspect came to the fore. And confronted with this reality, the Holy See, during the discussions of the CCW, the Convention on Certain Weapons regarding, above all, explosive remnants of war, the Holy See took the initiative of proposing a moratorium on the use of these bombs, and then called for a legally binding instrument to resolve the problem. In particular, the concern is to regulate the use of cluster bombs on populated areas and to have the technology in the production of these bombs to be more precise so that the failure in the explosion of these bombs will be enormously reduced, and in that way we would prevent continued victims.
Would you go as far as to say that ultimately cluster munitions could be eliminated, or at least becoming less and less acceptable, because like landmines, they continue to maim and kill innocent civilians a long time after the conflict has ended?
I think there is a parallel with mines, because these cluster munition bombs stay underground unexploded, and then they become deadly weapons when a child or a worker or a farmer step on them. And the long-range hope is that obviously this type of weapons will be banned completely. But in the meantime, it is important to arrive at a consensus that a moratorium is good for the international community. And second, that the technology used in the preparation of these bombs is such that when these weapons fall on the ground, they will shortly self-destruct, so they don't remain for a long time, and that they will be such that they will not be spread in areas where they are outside the military objective for which they are intended. So these are preliminary steps, but of course the ultimate goal, the ultimate desire is that these munitions that create so many victims will be totally eliminated.
Of course, talking about the fact that the cluster bombs have, there's a high incidence of bombs that fail to explode upon impact. It's estimated that around 1 million were left on the ground in Lebanon after the war in the summer of 2006. And you, in fact, described the use of cluster bombs there as a humanitarian tragedy, didn't you? Can you elaborate on that?
The problem at the end of the war in Lebanon has been exactly that. And in the last few days of the war, well over 1 million cluster bombs were dropped in all kind of areas. And we have constant, almost daily, victims as a result. Part of the problem there is that the technology of those bombs was very old, and therefore many of them did not explode at all and continue to do damage today. And now to demine or to collect and explode these munitions is an expensive and huge task. Secondly, there is a very specific humanitarian dimension to this problem, because there was the knowledge that they were very imperfect weapons in a way. It is said, to speak in this way, that we are talking of perfect and imperfect weapons, but that's the reality. And the fact that this was known and that there would be long-lasting negative consequences raise the awareness even higher that there is a need for the international community to become involved and to try really to control this type of munition and eventually to eliminate it.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, speaking to Susie Hodges. And finally, here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict devoted his reflections at this week's general audience to the inspiration given to all Christians by the women of the New Testament. My colleague Catherine Smybert has all the details.
As the Pope nears the end of his reflections on the earliest Christian witnesses, he turned his attention to the women who played an important role in spreading the good news, placing a special emphasis on Mary, the Mother of Christ.
As a faithful disciple of her son, Mary manifested her complete trust in him at Cana. She received a special mission from him at the foot of the cross, to be the mother of all disciples.
But during his address to the thousands of pilgrims gathered in the Paul VI audience hall, the Holy Father extended his list of noteworthy biblical females.
Others who assisted our Lord where Mary Magdalene, the first to announce his resurrection, as well as Joanna, Susanna, and the sisters Mary and Martha. St. Paul writes that in the early church, it was normal for women to prophesy under the influence of the Spirit.
Another woman who made an impact and also mentioned by Paul in his letter to the Romans was Phoebe, known as Diakonos, which shows, according to the Pope, that she had a unique responsibility in the early Christian community.
Indeed, the history of Christianity would have developed much differently if it were not for the generous contribution made by so many women. Today, let us give thanks to God, who through baptism continues to use the gifts of both men and women for the good of the entire church.
While speaking Polish and Hungarian, the Holy Father also acknowledged today's feast of Saints Cyril and Methodius, the figures who evangelized Slavic countries.
Upon all of you, I invoke God's blessings of peace and joy.
Meanwhile, a new book has been published this week, drawing together Pope Benedict's writings and reflections on the family as the foundation of society. The booklet, entitled The Truth About the Family, Marriage and De Facto Unions in the Words of Benedict XVI, was published by the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano and presented at a press conference on Tuesday. Here's Catherine Smybert again.
Vatican spokesperson Father Federico Lombardi launched the anthology this week, saying it serves as a good contribution to better understand the thoughts of the Pope on this theme of the family. He said that the correct compilation of the works helps us to more adequately understand the Pope's concerns and motivations behind them. Presented in abundance, they are in stark juxtaposition to the more superficial and improvised way these considerations are often portrayed. The director of the L'Osservatore Romano, Mario Agnes, said his group were motivated to join their work with the concerns of the Pope because they too refused to be silent on these issues.
Non posso tacere la mia preoccupazione per le leggi sulle coppie di fatto.
Mr. Agnes recalled the words that Pope Benedict had said to the Roman Curia last year on December 22nd that he could not silence his concern for civil union legislations around the world. We want him to be heard, said Mr. Agnes, and we saw this as an opportune moment to offer an anthology of the Pope's work as an instrument for reflection for all.
Col pensiero di un papa teologo,
President of the Union of Catholic Judges, Francesco D'Agostino, reminded those of us attending the launch that even before being made Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger had spoken extensively about our collective task to protect and promote the family and its traditional makeup. The professor added, though, that Christians shouldn't merely reduce the faith to a private experience, and said these works help us to be prepared to express our convictions more publicly to make a difference in society. A copy of the booklet, currently only available in Italian, can be obtained by writing a request directly via email to info@osrom.va or via fax at 06-698-82818.
My thanks to Catherine Smybert for that report. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Now stay tuned. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.